Hi, I'm Dr. Sam Bars. Thanks for downloading this episode of the Youth and Education Podcast, where we explore developments in education, research and policy that affect young people, primarily in the UK, with a range of expert guests. This podcast is brought to you by the Youth and Education Think and Action Tank, LKM Co. Oh, sorry, that was a real page turner. Welcome to this episode of the Youth and Education Podcast. This one's all about books and reading, and features three pieces of research handpicked by one of the newest members of our team, Alex Robertson. Alex and I talk about young people's reading habits, and why fewer of them seem to be reading for pleasure outside school. Then we look at ethnic representation within UK children's literature, and the stark finding that just 1% of the children's books published in the UK in 2017 had a non-white main character. Finally, we look at collections of LGBTQ fiction for teens in English public library services and the various ways in which we can measure the range of genuine choice that young people have when they go to take a book off the shelf. Thanks for listening.
LKM Co. believes society should ensure all children and young people receive the support they need to make a fulfilling transition to adulthood. Find us at lkmco.org. Can we listen to it now?
So I'm here with Alex Robertson, who's one of the newest members of the LKM Co. team.
Yeah.
It's all been going quite well, hasn't it, really, Alex?
It's been going very well, yeah. I'm feeling well settled in now.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear it. So we've got some cracking pieces of research to discuss today, but before we dive in at the deep end, in the time-honoured fashion, I wanted to hit you with the LKM Co. Youth and Education Podcast Icebreaker, which we reserve for all people on their maiden voyage on our illustrious podcast. And that is to ask you, of all the phases of education you've been through, Alex, which was your favourite? In which one did you feel the most joy?
It's easy for me because I had the loveliest primary school that you could possibly imagine. And I mean, it might be the fault of nostalgia, but I remember it being permanently sunny. And everyone just being absolutely delightful.
Is it in the UK?
Yeah, funnily enough. Don't remember whether I was actually there during the winter months, but no, it was wonderful. It was lovely. Really nice teachers. Lots of lovely friends. Lots of open fields to go and play in at break time. And I think they were really good at striking a balance between really encouraging you to learn and also just explore everything. We did lots of great school plays, and we had a little nature area where you can go and look in a pond and that kind of thing.
Excellent.
And I just have lots of very fond memories of that.
Oh, that sounds really good. The trickier part of the question, how would you rank the others? If you had to put them in order of preference, you know, where would you go with that ranking?
That's a really hard one. I think probably after primary school, I would say university, because that was really exciting for me. I went to Oxford, which I don't like to go on about too much, but it was...
You're constantly mentioning it, Alex.
Yeah, it is. I've just got to print it on a T-shirt. it was amazing. It was a bit of a punt, and I was very lucky to have got there. I had some really helpful teachers who were very supportive with the application and that sort of thing. And it was just quite magical, really, because I think I'd spent a lot of time imagining what it might be like, and it felt like something quite out of this world to both be there in terms of the place and how beautiful it is, and also some of the brilliant people who you get to learn with. I had some really fantastic tutors, and being able to sort of sit and talk to them one-to-one about something you're passionate about, which for me was English literature, is really, really special. So that was a lovely experience as well. Quite tough, obviously. Yeah. I don't look back that fondly on my final exams, but made it through. And then I think after that, it would be my postgrad in journalism at City University, which I did in 2013. And that was a really exciting experience, because I had kind of got to a point where I thought maybe I wouldn't go into journalism, but I decided to go for it and to focus on education, because I'd had a bit of time in teaching, And that all came together, and I learnt lots of really interesting things then, and had the chance to go out and do lots of exciting projects. And secondary school, the less said the better, really.
Okay.
It's awful.
Hence coming at the very bottom of your
ranking. Oh, yeah, okay. Rock bottom, I'm afraid.
Now that we've had a few of these questions posed to people on the podcast, I should really do some kind of analysis.
And yeah.
Because I was about to say, I feel like secondary is not doing particularly well.
I think secondary school is at a disadvantage because it's generally quite a difficult time in your life, I think, for most people, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's a lot of change to deal with.
Yeah, that's a good point.
People are mostly generally stressing out about something, whether it's work-related or social or whatever.
A lot of other stuff going on other
yeah,
than school.
Yeah, absolutely.
We should really get talking about the three pieces of research that you've brought to today's podcast, and they are all linked together very firmly with a central theme, which seems to be something distinctly around books and reading.
It
was World Book Day relatively recently, which wasn't necessarily a direct inspiration for these three pieces, but I thought that was quite nice as well. I remember not too distantly seeing lots of kids everywhere dressed up as book characters, which is always quite a...
Absolutely,
nice
yeah. World Book Day is lovely, and I think really important. And the first piece that I've got here was loosely linked to World Book Day, as it was talking a little bit about sort of the influence of that on young people's enthusiasm for reading. Mm. So the first piece I've got is actually an article from The Guardian talking about how older children should have story time in the same way as younger children to try to halt a fall in young readers. The headline, I think, needs to be taken with a pinch of salt, because it's looking at research from an organisation that is actually a company that analyses consumer book buying behaviour. So they have done a survey into the reading habits of children up to the age of 17, Nielsen Book Research, looking at basically who's reading, when, and why. And the findings led the publishing company that worked with Nielsen to stress that there's not enough story time happening with children. Some of the findings included that 32% of British children under 13 are read to daily by an adult for pleasure, and that is a decrease of 4% from the previous year and 9 percentage points from 2012. I think some of this finding is interesting, certainly, and I think there's a lot of factors at play here, but I think we need to very much take into account the fact that this is an organisation whose interest it is to encourage more people to be reading and reading with their children, because obviously they want people to be buying books. Mm. And that is the kind of backdrop that's behind some of the reasons for stressing how important it is to be reading with your children. Mm. I think another thing that struck me about this research was the idea that actually up to the ages of 12 and 13 you would be reading every day with your child. And I think there's a little bit of a question mark around that for me, because I think a lot of parents try to encourage a certain amount of independence with reading as children get older. And while you might read sort of at bedtime with younger children, I think as they get a little bit older and are heading towards secondary school, you are going to be encouraging them to making their own choices and reading independently. So maybe expecting parents to be reading every day with their children right up to them being a teenager is a little bit of a big ask anyway, perhaps.
And I, just to pause you briefly there, I found that one of the more interesting findings here is that when I was looking through, I thought, well, you know, kids maybe being read to less, that's not the only way of reading. You can also read yourself, you can read independently.
Indeed.
And if one is being substituted for the other, it's not necessarily, in my mind, a problem. So that it's a 13-year-olds reading independently, and it does seem like there is a strong link between being read to when you're younger and then reading independently. You're more likely to read independently if you've been read to lots when you're younger. So it's not just a simple case of it not mattering because kids are going to do it themselves anyway. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it sets children up well to be able to make some of those choices and to feel confident reading independently. And I think from my perspective, particularly as a former English teacher, that process of really guided reading from the age where children are almost just looking at the pictures, through to kind of shared reading, where maybe you're reading to each other, through to a child reading independently, is a really important process. Mm. And yeah, the idea that 74% of 8 to 13 year olds who were read to each day also read independently is obviously quite important. And 29% of those who were read to less than once a week. Is worth taking into account, but I think we're not necessarily getting the complete picture here in terms of they didn't necessarily break down how that reading process is working, and whether children are being read to at school. Books in the home is another big issue as well, and the company has looked at this as well. Mm. There are some quite interesting findings around, you know, how people have access to books. Particularly with local libraries being not as well stocked as they used to be.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of other factors here that maybe we need to be taking into account as well. The finding that boys were less likely to be read to than girls, 14% compared with 24%, is an interesting one for me. I wonder whether there's... it's not a kind of concrete idea at all, but the idea that maybe that girls would be encouraged to kind of be a little bit more bookish is certainly something that has been discussed before, and that boys are more kind of, boys will be playing outdoors and things like that. Mm. I think stereotypes around, gender stereotypes around those kind of interests of young children is something to bear in mind, certainly, and to encourage all children to take an interest in reading and to find books that are interesting to them is an important thing to do.
And the gender point, that distinction between boys and girls and the proportion who are being read to you didn't surprise me, because we know from previous research, I'm thinking of big reports like Read On, Get On from Save the Children, which have identified, you know, for a few years now we've known that there are quite stark differences in kind of early language development between boys and girls, for instance. Things related to reading and literacy. But the question that always comes to my mind is, well, what are they doing instead? Like, if parents are spending, if across the country we're spending, you know, hundreds of hours less each week reading to our boys than we are to our girls, what's happening instead?
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? And screen time is something that comes up in this research as well, which found that... the majority of boys and over half of girls in every age group preferred using and watching screens to reading books. Okay. So it was 76% of 8 to 10 year old boys, 58% of girls. So there is a divide there that maybe might be coming into play already. And I think that's something certainly to be aware of. I think the idea of screen time as just a negative experience is a bit generalised. There are some really, really productive things that parents can be doing with kids on tablets and things like that that are actually really useful for their learning. But obviously that needs to be balanced. And, you know, encouraging an interest in reading as well is something that's important.
Alex, what's up next?
Okay. The next piece that I've got that I have chosen, I thought I would take the idea of children's reading and look a little bit more in depth of the things that they're reading about. And I was really interested to find this survey by the Centre for Literacy in Primary Education, which was done last year and funded by the Arts Council, which looks at ethnic representation in children's literature. Mm. So it's... basically aiming to quantify and evaluate the extent and the quality of ethnic representation or diversity in children's books. So it's looking at things like the number of black or minority ethnic main characters, for example.
Okay.
So what they did was invited publishers to submit their examples of... fiction or non-fiction or picture books aimed at 3 to 11 year olds that featured black and minority ethnic characters. Okay. That had been published in the UK from 2017. And they then analysed what they got back in those findings. So they had a good look at all the different examples they've been given to assess how extensive the characters' involvement in the narrative was, whether they felt they were well represented, whether they felt it was more of a kind of a stereotype, and what kind of themes that they were engaging with as well.
Okay. It's just occurred to me that's actually a really interesting way of making sure you're getting, you're really kind of maximising that sample, because if you go to the main publishers and say, can you send us every title that you published in 2017 that had a non-white character in it or a non-white main character, because it's interesting actually if they kind of disaggregate between the two, then you know you're going to get kind of the very most from them, because they're going to want to demonstrate to you, you know, just how much they're publishing there.
Absolutely.
So, and it takes the work off the researcher and means that you... So it just occurs to me, it's a neat way of doing that. There would have been other methods, like just going through... I guess there will be a central list somewhere of everything that was published and manually doing it yourself, but go to the...
Yes, and we'll see that in the next piece that I'm going to look at, actually, okay, which is an interesting kind of contrast. But right, yeah, this is actually a very efficient way of gathering the information.
I thought so, right.
Because they want to be presenting themselves well.
They
found that of the 9,115 children's books that were published in the UK in 2017, there were only 391 that featured BAME characters, which comes to around 4%.
Okay.
And only 1% had a BAME main character, which I think is pretty shocking, really.
Yeah, that's really low.
Yeah, and disappointing. And I think one of the other things that really stood out to me was the fact that in terms of looking at the themes that these books explore, a lot of them, 10% of the ones, they found were focusing on what they call social justice issues, and include things like war and conflict, and were focusing on kind of overcoming adversity and those types of experiences. There's only one book that they found that was defined as a comedy, and I think that says a lot about what kind of representations we're getting, I suppose, of non-white characters, really, and how if we want to be really having a diverse range of fiction, they should be included in all different types of stories.
Yeah, not just being present in the books, but present in a range of ways.
And I think for young people, it's really important to be able to access that range. I was pleased to see that this piece of research came up with a number of recommendations as well, which I think is really important. So they focused on suggesting that BAME characters shouldn't be defined by a struggle or a difference, and that they should be engaged in a proper representative range of narratives. You know, that I think it must have quite a strong influence on you to only ever see your characters that look like you who are in the background, or who are... and I mean, it was to a certain extent the sort of thing that... you could have complained about with some narratives for female characters, if you go back far enough, you know, the idea that the woman was always a victim who needed rescuing in a story, you know. You know, I think it's really important to challenge sort of narratives that show particular characters only ever represented in one way. And I think for young people to not be able to see themselves as the, you know, the focus of their story, it gives out a message about how important their experiences are, and how important their views are, and I think that's something that really needs challenging.
Yeah, nicely put. What have we got last?
Okay, so having looked at a representation of BAME characters, I thought I would also see if I could find any research on LGBTQ characters as well. And again, this is one... that's interesting to me, but partly because of my interest in graphic novels. Again, I'm really big fan of Alison Bechdel, who does some really fantastic graphic novels, both about her own life, but also about lesbian culture. And she has done some really excellent work that I'm a big fan of. I've kind of gone from that to look at other kind of similar works as a bit of a spin-off. So I thought I'd have a look at what the situation was like in fiction for young people. And again, a little disappointing, unfortunately. This research is a little bit older than the last piece.
And it's looking at libraries, isn't it?
It's looking at libraries, yeah. So it's from 2016, and it's looking at collections of LGBTQ fiction for teenagers in English public library services.
Okay.
As you were saying before, this is it's a different approach to this one. So the idea was to look through library catalogues to collate information on which books were out there and where and how many copies were available as well, which is another important factor.
Ah, okay, right.
So it looked at 13 public library services, and they acknowledge in the research that that's only a small sample, and therefore it's difficult to say that the findings are necessarily representative across the whole country, but it gives you a good idea, a starting point, and they try to choose a range of different library services from different areas, different characteristics. And the findings sort of shortlisted books that they could find with LGBTQ characters in that they would look for in the library catalogues, and they slimmed them down to a list of sort of recommended books.
Okay.
So they divided it between any books that could fall into the category of LGBTQ representation. They also did a shorter list of the ones that they felt were really high quality.
Okay.
That avoided any kind of out-of-date stereotypes or that kind of only had fleeting mentions.
Okay.
And then they looked at how both cropped up in the library services.
Mm.
So of 476 LGBTQ teen fiction titles that they identified, the greatest number held across the library services they looked at was 107. Or 22.5%. And the lowest number held was 55, or 11.6%.
Mm.
So not huge amounts.
So relatively small proportions of that recommended list being reflected in the holdings that libraries have.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that they found was that the libraries that had a bigger budget had a kind of a more copies of things available, but were tended to be playing it safe and having the more mainstream sample. So they would have, rather than having a good sort of representative spectrum of titles available and the number of copies of each, they had gone for more kind of popular, more well-recognised titles and had more of those.
From this recommended list?
Yeah.
Okay.
And at the sort of smaller libraries, there were a couple of examples where librarians had obviously only had a small budget but had chosen quite carefully.
Yeah.
And one of the recommendations from the findings is that we need to see more of that.
Mm.
That generally, even though it's quite a small sample, from what they saw, there weren't enough examples of librarians being able to say, yeah, this is what we've got and this is why I chose it. I looked specifically for something that I felt was, giving a good representation of this, this, and this. And they were trying to say, that's something we need to encourage more.
Mm.
Another issue was that they looked at accessible formats as well, which I thought was quite an interesting
angle. Yeah, I noticed that.
Mm. So actually, across the board, the access to things in accessible formats was really quite poor. So they found that a lot of the books that they had looked at on their list were available in things like an ebook or other formats. You could get them out there in the world, but libraries didn't have them.
They interviewed librarians too, which I thought was interesting. There were some quite telling comments in there about there are some pressures that librarians face, for instance, to boost kind of circulation. So you need to, there's a certain incentive there to hold titles that you know are going to fly out the door so that you can prove that your library service is actively being used. Particularly in the current climate of austerity, it's crucial that public services can demonstrate they're being used, but that could be an incentive which works against, the need to hold, or to kind of, to push your holdings in directions that might be new to some people, but that need to be there and need to be available.
And encourage young people to try those as
well. And do we know anything about, of the relatively limited collections that these libraries held of LGBTQ, literature? Was there, are they popular or do they just sit on the shelves?
Again, it's there's a case where there's a few that have done really well, okay. that libraries are sort of playing it safe a bit by choosing those that have kind of had that additional success and maybe a bit more publicity.
Okay.
Maybe. So there's ones like, I don't know whether you know Antango Makes Three?
No.
Which is a children's book for quite young children based on the story of the penguins in Central Park Zoo.
Okay.
So it's based on a real life situation where they have these two penguins. They're called Roy and Silo, and they are a couple, and they adopted a baby penguin, and the real life story was made into a picture book for children, kind of up to about age 5.
Oh, ace!
And it's really popular. It did really, really well,
okay.
and attracted quite a lot of attention. And that you see kind of these key texts that have kind of taken off a bit more, and taken a theme or included LGBTQ characters, but been accepted into the mainstream, been received really well, and libraries are opting maybe for some of those safer options,
okay.
where they know, okay, this one everybody says is good, we'll definitely go with this.
You can see that a kind of market operates within something like a library service, even though it's a public service. There is a market there in that, you know, you can walk in, you've got all the books in front of you, and people choose. And certain books will do really well, that they're never available because everyone wants to read it.
Mm.
And other books, you know, in the old days when they actually stamped the date, you could see the last time that someone's taken out a book and you can tell if it's one that isn't very popular.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's an example of where the market isn't actually, it's rarely young people making those decisions, you know. You can try and get your kids to help you choose the books in the library, but when they're really young, you end up choosing the books for them. The librarians, who are also adults, are choosing which books are available in the first place. And so actually, it's a bit like school choice. Really, it's a market in which you're looking at adults' preferences more than anything. And so it's always interesting to think, well, what books would the kids actually go for if they had completely free rein in the library and if the titles in front of them weren't a kind of a filtered...
Mm.
An adult filtered selection of what's actually out there. I don't know
how
we would know what would happen there, but I'm pretty sure kids would read a wider range of stuff because particularly when they're young, they don't have many of the prejudices that we develop as we get older. We've come to time, Alex. Something I'm aware of is that, as usual, there's a lot of very sobering findings to be drawn from this set of research. I think it's, maybe it's not specific to our field and our sector, but there's always a lot of sobering stuff to read. Are there any particularly positive things in here that we can take away? Not that it's not useful or valid to focus on situations when they are pretty bleak, but are there any kind of positive things that we can take away?
Definitely. I think not to lose sight of the fact that the market for children's literature is still coming along really well. So there's obviously still children out there who are reading and enjoying books. Otherwise, we wouldn't have so many new authors.
Mm.
And I think things like the initial article, getting it out there into the news to remind people that, you know, the importance of children reading, it does have an impact, and people will see that and say, I need to step up. And make sure that that's something that I bear in mind. And I think the final piece of research, I was really encouraged by some of the actions that they'd done as a result as well. So they shared all of their findings about the LGBTQ teen fiction with the libraries that participated. And they had one library that they had been working with had already changed its approach before they published the research, which I thought was great.
Nice.
And they had reassessed the materials that they had and gone out to buy and promote different texts.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, the checklist of recommended books that they had drawn up that had the best representations and the most kind of diverse and interesting content, they distributed to all of the public libraries and librarians across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of presented a bit of information and said, if you're not sure where to go and what to find, here's a set list that you can work from, which hopefully will be a really good resource for librarians who are a little bit more hesitant and are looking for things that they can include. And I think that's a really good step to getting people to change their practice.
Yeah, something really practical coming out of it there.
Mm.
And there was one of the interviewees that they spoke to reported being shocked at finding out how limited their holdings were. And I think that's a really interesting example of how you can do research involving frontline practitioners who may have been in that role for years or even decades. And you can conduct some research and present them with those findings, and you can blow their perceptions of their role or their settings out of the water, because in a way, the more familiar you are with your surroundings, the less accurate your picture is of them. And I think this was a really neat example of research going in and saying, actually, you might think you know your holdings well, but you maybe don't. And that it sounds as though it's enabled some practitioners to kind of have a really positive moment of reflection and then change what they're doing. Which sounds great.
Absolutely, and in a context where people are distracted by budget cuts and things like that, it helps to refocus a bit and say, remember, you know, the original role of your job, and gives them a good stepping point to say, no, I need to get back out there and think more widely.
Yeah, nice. Thanks, Alex. Hope to see you again soon on the podcast.
Yeah, look forward to it.
We love making this podcast. If you enjoy listening to it as much as we enjoy making it, there's a few things that you can do. 1. Subscribe. Hit the subscribe button in iTunes or wherever you're listening. 2. Share. Share this episode with someone who you know will find it interesting or was affected by the specific issues we've covered. 3. Review. Write a review or leave a comment. Also, feel free to contact us via the links on the show notes. Thanks a lot!